looked more beautiful and intricate every time it was lifted to the light, were there in full force, of course. Friday nights, under a full moon that filled the black satin sky with a light as soft and delicate as the flickering of a candle. The road trips to Irving and Abilene and San Angelo in that endless caravan of RVs and Suburbans and plain old sedans rising forth so proudly from the bowels of West Texas. The family reunion atmosphere of each practice where they knew everyone and everyone knew them. They could hardly wait.
I have to have something to look forward to, or life is just a blah, was the way Jim Llewellyn, a retired grocery chain supervisor, had put it earlier in the month, as he sipped on an iced tea over at Grandy's and counted off the days until the beginning of practice. That football is just something that keeps me going. You know the kids' moves, you know 'em personally. Yes, just like your own kids, said Llewellyn, built solidly with a fine shock of gray hair, who didn't look right unless he had a thick wad of tobacco chew nestled inside the deepness of his cheeks as sweetly as a squirrel burrows a nut away in its mouth. Mojo football, it helps you survive all this sand, the wind, the heat. I wouldn't live any other place.
Bob Rutherford, who was sitting next to him in the booth and spent his days in the Herculean task of trying to sell real estate in Odessa, felt the same stirrings.
It's just a part of our lives. It's just something that you're involved in. It's just like going to church or something like that. It's just what you do.
They wouldn't have missed the watermelon feed for the world. Neither would Ken Skates, a gentle man with a soft sliver of a voice who had been to the very first Permian practice in the fall of 1959 when the school opened. Since that time, he had missed few practices, and it went without saying that he hadn't missed any games, except for the time he had heart bypass surgery in Houston. But even then, he had done what he could to keep informed. After his surgery, he had resisted taking painkillers, so he would be conscious for the phone calls from his son-in-law updating him every quarter on the score of the Permian-Midland League game. When he learned that Permian had the game safely in hand, he then took his medicine. More toward the back of the room was Brad Allen, president of the Permian Booster Club in the early 80s when billionaire businessman H. Ross Perot had made his pitch for educational reform in the state. Perot had routinely rubbed shoulders with the most powerful men in the world, presidents, senators, heads of state, chief executive officers of Fortune 500 companies. But the machinations behind building up multi-million-dollar companies or working up a deal to get the hostages out of Iran proved to be mere trifles in comparison to what happened when Perot threatened the sanctity of football in Odessa. The dominance of football in Texas high schools had become the focus of raging debate all over the state in 1983. The governor of Texas, Mark White, appointed Perot to head a committee on educational reform. In pointing to school systems he thought were skewed in favor of extracurricular activities, Perot took particular aim at Odessa. On ABC's Nightline, he called Permian fans football crazy. And during the show, it was pointed out that a $5.6 million high school football stadium had been built in Odessa in 1982. The stadium included a sunken artificial surface field 18 feet below ground level, a two-story press box with VIP seating for school board members and other dignitaries, poured concrete seating for 19,032, and a full-time caretaker who lived in a house on the premises.
"He made it look like we were a bunch of West Texas hicks, fanatics," said Allen of Perot. "The stadium was something the community took a lot of pride in, and he went on television and said, 'You're a bunch of idiots for building it.'"
Most of the money for the stadium had come from a voter-approved bond issue. the war against Perot escalated quickly. The Booster Club geared up a letter-writing campaign to him, state legislators, and the governor. Nearly 1,000 letters were sent in protest of Perot's condemnation of Odessa. Some of the ones to him were addressed, "Dear Idiot," or something worse than that, and they not so gently told him to mind his own damn business and not disturb a way of life that had worked and thrived for years and brought the town a joy it could never have experienced anywhere else. "It's our money," said Allen, of the funds that were used to build the stadium. "If we choose to put it into a football program, and the graduates from our high schools are at or above the state level of standards, then screw you. Leave us alone." At one point, Perot, believing his motives had been misinterpreted, and hoping to convince people that improving education in Texas was not a mortal sin, contemplated coming to Odessa to speak. But he decided against it, to the relief of some who thought he might be physically harmed if he did. "There are so few other things we can look at with pride," said Allen. "We don't have a large university that has 30,000 or 40,000 students in it. We don't have the art museum that some communities have and are world-renowned. When somebody talks about West Texas, they talk about football. There is nothing to replace it. It's an integral part of what made the community strong. You take it away, and it's almost like you strip the identity of the people." The pull of it seemed irresistible. Allen's stepson, Philip, had been a fullback on the 1980 Permian team that won the state championship. Allen readily admitted that Philip was not a gifted athlete, but he had the fire and desire that came innately in a town that drank as deeply from the chalice of high school football as Odessa. Allen knew Philip was something special in eighth grade when he had broken his arm during the first defensive series of a game. Rather than come out, he managed to set it in the defensive huddle and played both ways the entire first half. By that time, the arm had swelled up considerably to the point that the forearm pads he wore had to be cut off, and unwillingly, he went to the hospital. Allen said he was not proud of the incident, but he told the story freely, for it showed that his son had the ingredients to wear the black and white. And certainly he wasn't the only one to have learned the much-admired lesson of no pain, no gain. In seasons past, playing for Permian had involved other sacrifices. It had meant the loss of a testicle to a sophomore player when no one bothered to make sure he was thoroughly examined after he had injured his groin several hours earlier during an away game. Subsequently, the testicle swelled up to the size of a grapefruit, and by the time the doctor saw him, it was too late. It had to be removed. His mother was livid at what had happened, but the player pleaded with her not to push it because he feared it might interfere with his career at Permian and be held against him. He lost the testicle, but he did make All-State. In seasons past, playing for Permian had meant routinely vomiting during the grueling off-season workouts inside the hot and sweaty weight room. It had meant playing with a broken ankle that wasn't x-rayed because if it had been known that it was broken, the player would have had to have sit out the next game. It had meant playing with broken hands. It had meant a shot of Novocaine during halftime to mask the pain of a deep ankle sprain or a hip pointer. It had meant popping painkillers and getting shots of Valium. But few in the community blanched at any of these things, or even questioned them. Because of such an attitude, Permian had established itself as perhaps the most successful football dynasty in the country, pro, college, or high school. Few brands of sport were more competitive than Class 5A Texas high school football, the division for the biggest schools in the state. Odessa was hardly the only town that nurtured football and cherished it and went crazy over it, but no one came close to matching the performance of Permian. Since 1964, it had won 4 state championships, been to the state finals a record 8 times, and made the playoffs 15 times. Its worst record in any season over that time span had been 7-2, and its winning percentage overall, .825, was by far the best of any team in the entire state in the modern era of the game, dating back to 1951. All this wasn't accomplished with kids who weighed 250 pounds and were automatic major college prospects, but with kids who often weighed 160 or 170, or even less. They had no special athletic prowess. They weren't especially fast or especially strong. But they were fearless and relentlessly coached, and from the time they were able to walk, they had only one certain goal in their lives in Odessa, Texas. Whatever it took, they would play for Permian. Behind the rows of stools stood the stars of the show, the members of the 1988 Permian Panther High School football team. Dressed in their black game jerseys, they laughed and teased one another like privileged children of royalty. Directly in front of them, dressed in white jerseys and forming a little protective phalanx, were the Pepettes, a select group of senior girls who made up the school spirit squad. The Pepettes supported all teams, but it was the football team they supported most. The number on the white jersey each girl wore corresponded to that of the player she had been assigned for the football season. With that assignment came various time-honored responsibilities. As part of the tradition, each Pepette brought some type of sweet for her player every week before the game. She didn't necessarily have to make something from scratch, but there was indirect pressure to because of not-so-private grousing from players who tired quickly of bags of candy and not-so-discreetly let it be known that they much preferred something fresh-baked. If she had to buy something store-bought, it might as well be beer, and at least one player was able to negotiate such an arrangement with his Pepette during the season. Instead of getting a bag of cookies, he got a six-pack of beer. In addition, each Pepette also had to make a large sign for her player that went in his front yard and stayed there the entire season as a notice to the community that he played football for Permian. Previously, the making of these yard signs, which looked like miniature Broadway marquees, had become quite competitive. Some of the Pepettes spent as much as $100 of their own money to make an individual sign, decorating it with twinkling lights and other attention-getting devices. It became a rather serious game of, can you top this? And finally, a dictum was handed down that all the signs must be made the same way, without any neon. A Pepette also had responsibility for making smaller posters, which went up in the school halls at the beginning of each week and were transferred to the gym for the mandatory Friday morning pep rally. The making of these signs could be quite laborious as well, and one Pepette during the season broke down in tears because she had to stay up until the wee hours of the morning trying to keep up with the other Pepettes and make a fancy hall sign that her player never even thanked her for. These were the basic Pepette requirements, but some girls went beyond in their show of spirit. They might embroider the map of Texas on towels and then spell out Mojo in the borders, or they might make Mojo pillowcases that the players could take with them during road trips. Or they might place their fresh-baked cookies in tins elaborately decorated in the Permian colors of black and white. In previous years, Pepettes had made scrapbooks for their players, including one with a cover made of lacquered wood and modeled on Disney's Jungle Book. The book had clippings, cut out in 90-degree angles as square and true as in an architectural rendering, of every story written about the Permian team that year. It also had beautiful illustrations and captions that tried to capture what it meant to be a Pepette. The countryside was filled with loyal and happy subjects serving their chosen panther, said a caption in a chapter entitled Joy. And next to it was a picture of a little girl with flowers in her hand going up to a panther, the Permian mascot, roaring under a tree. The watermelon feed began with a prayer by one of the pastors at Temple Baptist Church, the biggest church in Odessa. The sign in front of the church in previous years had contained such inspirational messages as, How do you spell defense?
Mojo.
We thank you for the joy the athletes bring to our hearts and lives, the pastor said. Following the prayer, a video was shown of highlights from the past season in 1987. Since the team had gone to the semifinals of the state playoffs before losing to the eventual champion, Plano, it had been considered not a great year, but at least a pretty good one. There were sporadic yells of mojo, but the crowd in the cafeteria didn't become animated until the screen showed running back Sean Crow breaking tackle after tackle in the quarterfinal playoff game against Arlington. At one point, Permian trailed in the game 28-7, but then the team put on a miraculous comeback, rallying around the example of one player who got in his stance, vomited through his helmet because he had just taken a hit in the stomach, and then took his defender down with a crushing block. The performance of Crow was also inspiring. Late in the fourth quarter, he scored his fourth touchdown of the game to make it 35-33, and then he scored the two-point conversion to tie it up, even though everyone in the stadium knew he was going to get the ball. The game ultimately ended in a 35-35 tie, and Permian advanced to the semifinals of the playoffs based on a tiebreaker rule that provided that the team with more first downs advanced to the next round. Everyone seemed mesmerized as they watched Crow on a small screen in the front of the cafeteria, the memories of it, the absolute magic of it suddenly flooding back. The oil economy could go to hell. The country could go to hell. But thanks to Sean Crow, never, ever Permian football. It would be hard anywhere in sports to find athletic feats more courageous than his. On play after play, each like a dizzying rerun, he had headed down the sidelines, running so low to the ground that it sometimes seemed as if his helmet skidded the turf, retaining remarkable balance, sending would-be tacklers flying and dragging others for 4 or 5 yards before finally going down. It was the kind of performance that only occurred in high school, for no adult would have had the willingness to sacrifice his body as Sean Crow had done that night, for his family and his team and his town. It was also a moment, a time in his life, that seemed impossible to repeat.
If that won't get you excited, I can't believe you can get excited, said Booster Club President Doug Hendrick.
When the highlight film showed Crow scoring the two-point conversion, the crowd rose to its feet and gave the former hero a standing ovation. He was in the audience and gave no reaction, as if he was slightly embarrassed and wished he were someplace else. He was supposed to have been at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, the only Division I school that had actively recruited him after a senior year in which he gained 2,288 yards and made first-team All-State. But during the high school All-Star football game in July at the Astrodome between players from the north regions of Texas and ones from the south, he had felt an intense pain in his back. No one thought it was serious, particularly since he had a reputation for whimpering. And one coach at Permian, who knew Crow well, said that the best way to shut him up was just to give him the ball.
I can't run, man, he told Tim O'Connell, the Permian trainer who was nicknamed Trapper, and was the trainer for the North during the All-Star game.
Crow's voice, high-pitched and laced with pain, made him sound almost scared.
Why don't you just try, said Trapper, who examined him and could find no discernible injury.
Crow continued to play in the game, biting down on his mouthpiece as hard as he could on each play to fight through the pain. After the game, it turned out that Crow had not been whimpering. He was diagnosed with a herniated disc, and the TCU coaches told him not to come to school until January, after he had had a chance to rehabilitate. There was no point in coming to school just to go to class. Injuries were nothing new to Crow. In seventh grade, he had broken his leg in practice. In eighth grade, he had torn ligaments in his thumb. In ninth grade, his arm, already injured from an incident involving an all-terrain vehicle, had been shattered when he tried to throw a block. Off the field, he was an endearing, friendly kid, quiet and shy.